So it's a pleasure to be here, and I will be here today and tomorrow as well. And I'm leaving late tomorrow, taking train to San Diego. So my background is astrophysics. Because the previous week was heavily involved in magnetic magnetized turbulence, I deliberately removed everything magnetic from my talk. So this will be mostly hydrodynamic turbulence in molecular clouds where the stars are forming. And so I would like to mention my collaborators that were some time ago all together in San Diego, but they are now at different places. And so you cannot see this. Rick Wagner helps me with data analysis. Then Mike Norman helps with discussions, funding, and stuff like that. David Collins is doing very interesting work with adaptive mass refinement and in MHD turbulence and star formation. Pan Liubin is helping with some turbulence subjects here. Sergei Ustyugov is another numerical guy that helps from Russia. He comes from Keldysh Institute of Applied Mathematics in Moscow. And Paolo Padovan is a great enthusiast of star formation. So we are motivated by this interesting problem, outstanding problem of trying to describe how stars are forming. And we are after understanding of what determines the mass distribution of stars, how they form, what does the star formation rate depend on. And so questions are like this. And our ultimate goal is to become to be able to model star formation in supercomputers from first principles. And so it appears that turbulence, interstellar turbulence, is the key process here. And you cannot really make your first step towards stars if you don't understand this turbulence, because it creates essentially initial conditions for stellar collapses. And so you if your initial conditions are wrong, then the collapse will proceed, but the object that you get at the end will not be related to stars in any sense, to real stars. So what we want to do here is just to discuss the very first baby steps, understanding what sort of turbulence there is. And turbulence that determines this star formation process is very highly compressible. Stars are forming in molecular clouds that are cold clouds with supersonic RMS velocities inside. And so compressibility plays a very important role there. It's not like, you know, we have different grades of compressible turbulence. Near incompressible, weakly compressible, compressible. So this turbulence is highly compressible. So that's the key here. And then magnetic fields play a very important role, but I will not be talking about them today. And so sometime, usually when I talk about turbulence and star formation, people are asking, what is self-gravity? Do you really need self-gravity to make stars? Yes, we do, and that's also a very important part. And without numerical methods, you cannot really solve the problem. So there are several important pieces here. And I will be talking today mostly about the first and the third one. But if there are some, if there is any interest in the other ones, we can discuss this offline. Okay, so what I will talk about today is mostly scaling, intermittency, and compressible cascade as we see this in our simulations. And of course, there is no you cannot model this sort of turbulence in laboratory experiments because the Mach numbers are so high. And so those experiments would be very expensive, and you just cannot reach those Mach numbers there. So the only way to go is numerical simulations. I will not be talking about this subject, and I will talk about this, and then we'll give a summary at the end. So let's start with a little bit of astrophysics. This is our motivation, basically. So these three pictures show multi-scale turbulence in the disk of our Milky Way galaxy. So the scale of this window is about 200 parsecs squared. And you see how see a lot of structures. And if you zoom in, you see a lot of... this is something that shows dust structures. It's actually temperature. But it's kind of nice to show this, you know, there are structures on all scales present there. And so this turbulence on scales of about 100 parsecs in the galactic disk is basically steered by star formation, by energy from supernovae explosions and accretion of external gas onto the galactic disk, differential rotation of the gas in the disk, and so on and so forth. So
this is what you call active galactic nuclear?
No. This is just ISM. It's not related to the central parts of galaxies where the nucleus would be. It's everywhere in the disk where stars are forming today.
Also, why do you call this turbulence? This complicated pattern could be the result of a smooth random advection without any turbulence in it?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So I think in a couple of slides I will show you something that would probably help you to understand that. So
you say that the structures here are differences in temperature rather than density.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just an illustration. It's not exactly the temperature, so it's something that you see in the infrared light, and that's something that but what I want to show here is that there's a multitude of scales, and there are structures everywhere on all scales.
Yeah. Incidentally, what are the temperatures we're talking about here?
Temperatures in molecular clouds are about 10 Kelvin.
Yeah.
So these are very low. But this picture doesn't, it's just more than just molecular gas. On those scales of about 100 parsecs, you have a mixture of different phases in the ISM. And there is warm gas, cold gas, there is thermal instabilities that help to redistribute gas from different phases to other phases. And so I'm not going to talk about this. So most of the topic of today will be, we'll deal with cold gas inside molecular clouds on smaller scales. So we will go deeper to box like this, smaller than this lower left box here.
Yeah. The time scale for gas to lose heat by radiation is roughly what? Is it?
It's very short compared to the hydro time. So these clouds are isothermal, basically. So we can safely use on those scales at those densities. You can safely use the isothermal equation of state. And so it will be about isothermal supersonic turbulence.
What portion of the galaxy was that?
What
portion of the galaxy was that? Like Orion cloud or what portion of
what galaxy? Portion? Oh. I think it says here something. This is Eagle Nebula, so this part. But it doesn't matter. It looks all the same, more or less. This is nearby, this ISM is close to the sun, so it's what we can observe with high resolution. So here is an example of...
it's density.
Yeah, for this audience, it should look like density. So it's not actually density, it's column density that you see in 12CO. But we can talk about it as a column density. So. This is a classical example of torus molecular cloud. And you see that there is a lot of structures. So this, the scale of this picture is about 20 parsecs. So you see a lot of dense filaments. The black stuff is very dense. The white stuff is lower density. And you see a lot of structure here. And it's a classical object. The stars are forming right there in those dark filaments.
The darkness could also be dust, right?
So, sorry?
The dark thing could also be dust.
Yes, sure. Yes, yes. And so that's, I hope this will partly at least address your question about why the structures are called turbulence here. And so what is observed, if you measure the velocity difference as a function of distance between two points in those clouds, you get a plot like this.
It's RMS?
No, this is something, very close to the first order structure function.
Longitudinal transverse.
But it you can it's along this I think it is mostly longitudinal should be this is distance in parsecs.
Uh-huh.
And that is delta v in kilometers per second. So what you see is basically is a very nice power law here.
Yeah.
And so there is some dispersion around it, and that black line here that is shorter is sort of the first attempt to measure this that dates back to 1981. And the rest of the data is more recent, and so that's the sound speed, right? So all these motions are supersonic, and the correlation is pretty tight, although So the power index here is substantially larger than it would be for Kolmogorov turbulence.
Well, is this 0.2 is somehow it's hard to believe when you look at the scatter of the data.
It's something in some sort of formal error that is determined by
formal error in the size of the circle
by some fitting
scatter of the circle.
I wouldn't pay too much attention. In astrophysics it's not like you can measure it with your in the lab. So
the viscosity, what is the viscosity?
It's just collisions between molecules, basically, essentially. That is the viscosity. So the
you estimated concretely how?
Yeah.
The mean free path.
Using mean free path. Yes. This stuff. This sort of stuff. Thermal velocities and that. So the Reynolds numbers are about 10^8. The outer scale.
It's small. I mean, with the molecular viscosity. Been pretty small at distance in parsecs. So what is this?
Density
is not very large here. It's kilometers per second.
It's 10 Kelvin. Sound speed is small.
It's 100 meters per second.
If this is turbulence, what's the energy source driving it?
The energy source, as I said, star formation itself. So you have supernova explosions that inject 10^51 ergs locally in the ISM, and then they send shock waves. Those shock waves redistribute density, they collide with each other and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
This source is sufficient to drive this sort of turbulence, but there are other sources, and there is no convergence in the astrophysics community to any one source, and probably there is no one source that but I think people agree that the outer scale is about 70-50 parsecs. So, and then what we see here is sort of a cascade. It's not really the cascade for the first structure function, but first the structure function, but you can think of.
Do you agree that on the scale of up to 100 parsecs, the sound speed should be more like 10 kilometers per second?
It's a good question, but what people are looking here at is molecular gas, and so there may be patches of molecular hydrogen embedded into warmer gas. That is an option, and we are modeling this also. in with magnetic field and thermal effects. But for those cytothermal models I want to discuss today, this is just 10 Kelvin. That's it.
How far does the influence of a single supernova explosion extend?
Oh, it depends on, usually they are clustered, so it affects a scale of about 100 parsecs. Roughly, that's how you get this 70 parsecs, typically, yeah. So, okay, so let me continue. And then if you want to look closely at a large sample of molecular clouds, so there are like, you know, 580 molecular clouds used here to do that plot. You can plot the mass of a structure that you estimate using some astrophysical ideas versus the size of that structure. And it appears that, you know, there is a very tight and nice correlation between the mass and the size.
But not R cube.
Not R cube. So you get some sort of fractal dimension, which is probably better called, it's not Hausdorff, but you can call it a mass dimension or something, which is a little bit lower, but consistently lower than 3. So the slopes, the typical slopes are about 2.3, 2.4, something.
It's still much larger than the fractal dimension of the overall universe.
I'm not sure. It's a good question. Overall is about 2, right?
Yeah. All this pancake net.
Pancakes have 2, I think.
1.7?
But
who knows
where
that's accurate?
I thought it was Vaucouleurs from the Vaucouleurs measurement.
That will be on a really huge scale. Yeah,
huge scale.
Small scale.
That's sort of unrelated. So what I want you to see here is just another tight correlation that tells you that there is a structure in the density distribution in those clouds present on all scales, again below this holy number of 100 parsecs. Okay, I will skip this, but that shows the direction of the magnetic field. And so that's a complication we are fighting against in this picture, but I am not going to discuss this. So it's again the Taurus cloud and little dashes show the direction of local magnetic fields. And so this is where the stars are forming. So the same Taurus clouds and different symbols show stars of different ages. And you can see that most of them are tightly related to the filaments, but as they age, they start to, you know, get out of there.
So you resolve single stars.
These are single stellar objects.
Sure, that
yes.
Those black regions aren't many stars together, and they're really dense.
No, it's different. It's a different line, and of course, yeah. It's just an over plot. So let me start with the first topic. I want to discuss scaling and self-gravity and. Let's start with scaling, and I'll see how this goes. Maybe we can skip the second part. So this is a brief history of simulations of compressible turbulence, and I was not able to fit everything in here, but it's just a sample of what has been done. But what is interesting is how it evolved from 64 cubed in the 70s, and that was the first DNS, and then there was a first compressible DNS nearly 10 years later, and that's when all the subject starts with simulations of compressible turbulence. Then there was a lot of seminal work done by basically two groups, Kida and Orzak, and David Porter, Annick Pouquier, and Paul Woodward, and others. And you can see how resolution improved. I think the Mach numbers were pretty low, so they were saying that they are modeling, some of them were modeling molecular cloud turbulence, but Mach numbers were lower because the funding sources are related to some agencies that need lower Mach numbers. And that's another actually challenge in this field, because it's really hard to find. It's an exciting field, but it's hard to find funding for Mach 6 turbulence here. So we started some time ago, about 4 years ago, running a simulation at 1,000 cubed at Mach 6, and that is the RMS Mach number for the box. And then we ran a little bit bigger a couple of years later.
If the gas can lose heat by radiation very quickly, why are large Mach numbers relevant? Why isn't it just Mach numbers close to one?
Why is Mach now? Because there is a constant supply of energy, so this kinetic energy gets resupplied.
Yeah.
On large scale, and then it just gets ultimately radiated away.
Yeah, but the characteristic time for a shock to cool would be what, 1,000 years or so.
Oh.
But even is a thermal case, you can have this huge difference in densities.
Yeah, the gas.
A large density contrast is not a large Mach number.
I mean, oh, we will get to this.
Time sound velocity.
Yeah, we will get.
But if the gas cools, then the velocity of the dense material just returns to that of the ambient gas. So
no.
No. Inertia. Nothing.
Just inertia. I mean, you can have shocks in isothermal gas. Just the speed of sound is different. It's not adiabatic; it's isothermal, and your shock is not hot. It just has the same temperature, but velocity is many times sound velocity, and density is a huge contrast.
Okay, but well, I'll ask questions later on about whether you put in cooling.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, we also run different sorts of simulations where we use the full equation of state, the energy equation. And then in that equation we have sources on the right-hand side. And those sources would represent heating in the ISM and cooling, and radiative cooling. Mm-hmm. So those are nonlinear additions, and we can do that as well. So that would solve the full system with nonlinear sources on the right-hand side. But this is sort of what I want to talk today. It's just a more simple case where we use the isothermal equation of state and just two equations instead of three. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about what we simulate. So we take a box with periodic boundary conditions, and what we solve is typically an Euler equation. We are not including the explicit viscosity term on the right-hand side. And it's a tradition in this field because you can get a wider range which would represent your inertial range with an approach like this. So this is called implicit large AD simulation, where implicit stands for numerical diffusivity that controls smaller scales. If we were to resolve real viscosity, that would require us to double the resolution of the box, or quadruple the resolution of the box, to get the same extent of the inertial range. And so we assume that the dynamics of this turbulence in the inertial range does not depend on the nature of viscosity. And the viscosity we have is purely numerical, and it's built into the numerical method that we are using for that.
Energy is conserved, which means that if you force, you have a steady state.
The force
is a mechanism of dissipation.
Yes. Yeah.
Just and shocks are treated just as discontinuous.
We are using piecewise parabolic method that is designed to treat shocks in the most nice way. So the shocks are very narrow in this numerical scheme, and it uses Godunov approach, where the solver has built into analytical solutions for Riemann problems. So that helps a lot. Okay, so before I go further, let me try to show you some movie. Oh. Okay.
Color is density?
Yeah, so this is a box at 2000 cubed, and what is shown here is projected density. White would be low density, yellowish would be high density, dark blue is in between. And so what you see here is just overlapping shocks. There is a lot of overlapping shocks, and it's just a cloudy structure. At large scales, we apply artificial random driving force that supplies the energy to the box. So that's how it works, basically.
It is Euler equation.
Sorry?
It is Euler equation without magnetic field.
Yes, this doesn't have magnetic field. Okay, so when we do simulations, we want to make sure that we simulate the right thing, right? So we want to check what is going on, and maybe we are doing something wrong. So one of the best checks here is to look for the probability density function of the gas density in the box. And from theory, it should be a log normal. And so what we see here, there is data shown for two different simulations with different driving forces. I won't go into detail here, but the bottom line is that at large densities where the PDF is the most stable, it can be represented very, very, very accurately by a log normal distribution. And this representation is good. Up to at least 8 orders of magnitude in probability. So
but and the right tail, the left tail?
The left tail is oscillating because rarefactions live much longer than strong shocks, right? And so you need to have a lot of snapshots of this flow to time average the left part nicely, but you can do that as well.
But red overshoots actually.
It's a different driving. Yes, it's a different driving pattern. So red uses solenoidal driving, which is not good for this model. It's better to inject energy on large scale with large scales with certain ratio of solenoidal and dilatational modes. And so normally it's 1 to 2. 1 for dilatational, 2 solenoid.
Is it the real theory? I mean, I don't remember. I mean, or it's some kind of.
It's just multiplicative thing.
What is the multiplicative thing? I don't. I just see random aggregation. There is no. Where is the multiplicative mechanism underlying this?
When you shock a shock inside the shock.
Yes, yes. So you have random multiplicative process when shocks interact with each other, and that creates a normal distribution of log density. That's how it comes, basically.
Does that also hold for the velocity?
No, I don't think so. Let me just point out another thing. So there is five plus orders of magnitude in density contrast. So that is very highly compressible, and this is partly due to very soft equation of state, which is the isothermal one that we are using here. But this is real astrophysics. But there is no single shock that creates that huge contrast.
But how are these shocks regularized at small scales?
It's mostly the numerical method does that. So you describe a shock as a big jump over one grid zone on the grid that covers the volume, basically 1.5 grid zones normally.
So some additional prescription which is added to the
yes. It's called shock capturing normally.
Is the driving a long wave driving in this simulation?
Yes, it's only It's limited to wave numbers 1 and 2, in between 1 and 2. Slightly, mm-hmm. a little bit over that, but mostly it's concentrated on very large scales. So box size and half box size.
Yeah. The physical process you envisage, which is supernova explosions, would have very intensely localized regions of energy.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. This is discussed in astrophysics a lot. The problem here is to have some simple prescription for driving that would not limit you your inertial range. Still, you need some simple driving force on large scale, and it should be you can take different forces, but with some force you need to wait longer for the system to, you know, to forget about the forcing and switch to an inertial range, and in other cases you we want to save here and we want to have as much of inertial range as possible, so that's how we optimize this force to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. If you did have intense point driving, that could affect the high density ratio tail of that distribution.
Yes, there are models like this in astrophysics. So you basically want to model a piece of the galactic disk that is larger than just a few parsecs. I'm talking about boxes on the order of 2 parsecs, 5 parsecs or so. So to do supernova energy injection in your simulation, you want to turn to boxes of 500 parsecs perhaps. To resolve several supernovae exploding simultaneously. And so that's a different setup. So we assume that there is a flux of kinetic energy coming from larger scales, from some source, but we want to include it in a simple, tractable way.
Is it possible to characterize this in terms of fractal dimensions?
That's the next slide.
Oh.
Yeah. So when you, if we have high enough resolution in the box, so 2,000 cubed is an ideal case, we can really look at the density distribution and use sort of box counting or mass dimension approach to estimate the fractal dimension here. And we are not talking about multifractality here, of course, but just one dimension is possible to estimate.
It is multifractality probably.
Yeah, but we cannot, at 2,000 cubed, we cannot address that, right? So what we see here is basically there are two slopes. On small scales, we have shocks, and those shock structures are naturally two-dimensional. And you see this is mass in the sphere of radius L divided by L squared. So fractal dimension of 2 would be horizontal line here. And then on larger scales, where we believe that there is a little piece of the inertial range here, we have slopes of 2.3, 2.4, depending on the
crossover scale. Do you understand this crossover scale?
I can talk about this. I think
your fractal dimension presumably will depend upon Mach number.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
So
yes.
Is there an observational indication that Mach number 6 is the relevant one to look at?
If I would say it would be probably for high enough Mach numbers, you would probably have the same sort of dimension here. But if the Mach number goes closer to 1, that should can change. So the critical boundary is typically at about 3, I think. And so that changes the geometry of shocks. At Mach numbers below 3, you have planar shocks running around in the box, interacting with each other. And at higher Mach numbers, you have higher density contrasts. And there are big, dense chunks of matter moving around. They create bow shocks around them, and so all the shocks get corrugated. So it's a little bit different geometry. And so what I want to mention here is that the slope we are getting is pretty close. It's hard to estimate it, and it's even harder to estimate it observationally. But we are sort of able to reproduce that correlation that I showed in a few slides.
Any theory predicts this number?
It's a good question. Yeah, some time ago there was some work published on Shilevek modeling of this turbulence, and it was returning a fractal dimension of about 2.3. Shilevek has, I think, a singular.
But Shilevek is just kind
of
fit for the data.
But it's not exactly relevant here, because this is just the mass density of fractal dimension. So I'm not sure there is a nice explanation for that. And now we can also, of course, we can compute structure functions, because we have all this nice data, and we produce pretty, we have many snapshots. We run the simulation for a few dynamical times to steer the turbulence, and then we continue for like six dynamical times to collect the statistics for the statistical steady state. And that's what we get for the first order structure function. We get slopes pretty similar to that other correlation I showed you. But so what it shows is super Kolmogorov slopes, much steeper. So Kolmogorov would be 1/3, and this is larger than 1/2 here.
That would give you a spectrum 1/k².
Yes, that's sort of what's expected, because there are shocks. And so when we first started doing that, the field was pretty undeveloped. So people didn't know much about how velocities are scaling there. And so because there were no high resolution computer modeling available at that time. So my idea was to just go through different statistics and look how they differ from the incompressible case. That's the most simple, naive idea that you can
Yeah, but 1/2 is something that one would expect just on this, that you have shocks, and so you have a random walk in the space of velocity. So yes. Suppose you go away, you have just random jumps because of shocks.
Yeah, but it's not
growth.
But it's not exactly Burgers turbulence, because there is a lot of vorticity involved in shocks, in
but
particular
shocks
in terms of corrugated.
If shocks are more important, then you would expect this.
Yeah. Okay. So then we looked at the second order structure functions, and of course there are a few exact results for incompressible turbulence, so it's always interesting to look what we get there. And so the slope was again higher, right? It's not 2/3.
But it's not twice, 15.5. It's already started bending, but that's what you would expect from intermittency. You would expect it to bend, so second moment is not twice the first.
Yeah, but if you look at this first von Karman-Hoover's relationship, it's funny, because its turbulence is roughly isotropic. You can still recover the same relationship, so those two lines go nearly parallel to each other. You see, there is a little difference in slope, but overall it's the same. But the coefficient is a little bit different, right? It's not 1.33, it's rather 1.3.
And with your accuracy, you trust that this difference is
true? I would put 1.3 here. I don't know. I don't trust it too much, because I know how it works, and I don't think that these numbers here are matter too much.
The thing is that he says it to separate a rotational pattern and potential pattern.
We've done that.
Of course, you can compare something like that.
Yes,
Because of such a comparison is not correct, in my opinion.
Oh, okay. So it's.
They are part of the same equation.
Okay. I'm not comparing here. I am just doing that simple thing. I just want to see how velocities differ from. I'm not saying that. In compressible turbulence, the same relationships are satisfied, like, for example, von Karman-Hoover. And we've done, of course, Helmholtz decomposition. We know what, and actually solenoidal velocities are dominating they contribute about 2/3 to the energy, so it's
at large scales they dominate. But when you go to smaller scales and start about asking about velocity differences and structure functions, that's a different story.
Okay, so then we look at the third order structure function. And so we want to look what happens to the 4/5 law here. And well, we find still steeper slopes. So if you just look at the velocity structure function of the third order, and I think this number is something intermediate between transverse and longitudinal. So longitudinal would be this red line, I think, right? And transverse would be green. So both structure functions have steeper scaling again. And so what we have here is apparently, okay, the story goes like this. When people were modeling this turbulence at Mach numbers close to one, they were always getting Kolmogorov everywhere in all those plots. And as we depart from that regime and we cross this critical point of Mach about 3, we get to a different, something different. And that allows us to reproduce observations better, right? Okay, so that shows you the decomposition, probably what you wanted to see here. So these are power specs, and so this is total velocity. It's not actually velocity power. So because it's compressible turbulence, it's better to weight the velocities with square root of density so that you get the kinetic energy distribution as a function of scale. And so the upper curve shows the total kinetic energy distribution, and we see this famous bottleneck here, which is expected. And then we see a little part that we believe is the inertial range, and then there is driving scale here. Okay, and so that lower curve shows you the solenoidal contribution to this. What is interesting here is that these two lines are very parallel to each other, which means that
you said the solenoidal is the most part of kinetic energy.
Yeah, I think
is a bit much smaller.
Is it much smaller or not? Actually, the
not
difference
much.
In logarithm is small.
Comparable.
But let me, maybe I need to.
It's log scale.
Yeah.
Come on.
Maybe I'm making a mistake. Maybe it's dilatational. So I'm kind of not sure here now.
Wait, solenoidal is red down there in your
yeah, it's this curve. So maybe I wouldn't sell it right now, so I would double check.
But the upper curve is total.
The upper curve is total. Solenoidal should be pretty close to total, but I'm not sure.
It's larger than the potential.
No.
Of course.
Solenoidal is larger than the potential.
Why would you see that?
Since the difference is only 1.2.
It's logarithmic.
In logarithm.
It's logarithmic. So maybe it's correct. Maybe it's correct.
It's like two-thirds.
It has been done long time ago. I hope it was done correctly, but I would double check.
But it's there for you.
But the interesting thing here, if you include that factor, then these two lines go exactly parallel. Look how close the numbers are here. But if you remove that square root of rho here, then you will get what you, Grisha, proposed, that on small scales there is more one mode and less another. Okay, so when you do this density weighting, and so to me it tells that there is some sort of compressible cascade. And the dilatational and solenoidal modes in that cascade are very tightly coupled. If you look at the real energy and you include that factor, so they go parallel to each other. So they are locally coupled in that cascade. And so that brings to some very simple ideas of how to proceed here. So I'm sure this is familiar to everyone here in this audience. So you can just from dimensional considerations get this relationship for structure function of order p, so from Kolmogorov 41, and you can repeat the same thing by just adding this factor of density here in front to get kinetic energy, and then this is just the time you need to the eddy time. And so I was looking for references, and I stopped looking when I found this Lighthill 55 that just mentions that, and in passing, you know, he just said, okay, if you have compressible turbulence, you probably need to put that. And I think everybody agrees with that. So if you have this, you can just redefine your velocity. And so you can say, okay, let's change variables to V, and V would be rho to the 1/3 times U. And then you can say, now I expect this scaling. So that would be for P equal 3, you would get 4/5 law, roughly, or at least this linear scaling for the third order structure function. And similar ideas were discussed before by Hendrickson, Flack in the astrophysical context. And so what we wanted to do is just to check what is going on here. And we checked what is happening in the simulation. So this plot shows you a diagram of scaling exponents. So these are absolute scaling.
Oh, is this velocity rho 1/3?
Oh, different ones, both. So that is just the velocity. And this black axis are velocity weighted with yes. And so you know, we didn't know that this is not exactly one here, but it's very close to one. So it's not actually, it's not that we are recovering the 4/5 law here, but what it tells us is that you just need to put this density back where it belongs, and you get something reasonably understandable, I think. And so there are also different intermittency models plotted here. So the red one is K41, and then the green one is Shilevek 94 for the incompressible case, and the pink one is proposed by Stas Boldriev and collaborators for velocity scaling, but they were looking in supersonic turbulence, but they were looking at, they were relying on extended cell similarity here. They didn't have enough resolution to measure the absolute scaling, so.
How does it compare to experimental data for just fluid turbulence?
Normal incompressible would be the green curve, green model proposed by Shilevek.
Not from a model, I mean experimental data, like from tidal measurements or some, like the water.
Shilevek was designed
to fit everything.
Yeah, well, not exactly, but
the black until six, it's pretty close to the experimental data, but I think
it makes it seem. Okay. So that's what we got. And now, here we are talking.
The water series is high degree of intermittency. Yeah?
Exactly. Yes, that's the next slide. Exactly. So, if you if we want to talk about intermittency, you can look at what, for example, the density as a function of time looks like. And so that plot shows you rho as a function of rho max as a function of time.
At one point.
It's a maximum in the whole box. It's not really, and here it's filtered, so it's a high pass filtering. And you see a lot of, so this strong oscillatory periods are corresponding to collisions of large dense blobs in the box. And so they create a lot of activity here. So yes, it's intermittent. And so this is how the structures would look like in the box. So this is just a zoom in on one structure in this box where this strong collision of different blobs of dense gas is happening. So this shows the projected density. And just black is higher density. and white is lower density. You can see this typical triangular structures. For instance, if you have a waterfall, water has a large contrast in density with respect to the air. You see similar structures in falling water, for example.
This is
geometrically, there is no similarity in physics here, but.
So what is this?
These are just Mach cones, because. So the leading thing here, there is a little blob of very dense material.
And it runs.
Yeah, it runs.
It's a little Mach cone.
Yeah. So this is dilatation. These are the shocks, basically. And that is vorticity.
They're closely correlated.
And vorticity is very closely correlated to shocks because of the vorticity generation mechanism that is built into this system. And you can compute, you can forget for a moment that we are solving the Euler equations. You can imagine that there is this explicit viscosity term present there. So if it were Navier-Stokes, then we could say, okay, we know how to compute the dissipation rate. And so you can open Landau-Lifshitz and get that formula out of it. And so the white here shows strong dissipation, black weak dissipation. So you see that dissipation is really localized in space, and the whole thing is very intermittent. And so
correlated to shocks, yeah?
Sorry?
And dissipation is also correlated to shocks.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And so then we have all this beautiful data, so we can ask a lot of interesting questions here. So one question is basically, this is work done by Pan Liubin from Arizona. And so what he said, hey, let's just check the validity of Shiele-Weck model and the applicability to the supersonic regime by just measuring local dissipation rates. And so what is explained here is that's the dissipation rate locally. And then you can compute the average dissipation rate as a function of scale by averaging different spheres in the volume. And we are not using spheres, but we are using boxes instead. And then you can compute moments of that thing, right, using this simple formula. And then you can say, okay, Shiele-Weck 94 predicts how this moment scale, right? And so you can try to feed this formula to the data we get from the model directly, right? And it produces nice results. So here are just the moments of orders 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. We are not going too far. And it's already difficult at order 4, because if you think about velocity structure functions, that would correspond to 12 here. And what we are doing here, we use forward sort of density weighting for the dissipation rate. So this dissipation rate is density weighted. And we get a very nice agreement with...
But what comes here is a fractal dimension, but you all have an independent measurement of fractal dimension, because that's what Shiele-Weck actually says, that it's, you just plug in fractal dimension. So if it fits...
The dimensionality
this
here...
2.3
Yes, we 0.7. Can... No, with velocities, with dissipation. Dissipation is not exactly density, and you can tell because it looks different, right, on that picture.
0.7 seems to fit with 3 minus 2.3.
No, it's this D, you need to compare this D.
Yeah,
so D is 1.9, we have 2.3 for the mass. So I would say, as expected, these numbers are different.
So these structures are different for different
our structures in density and in dissipation cannot be the same. Yeah, it's really these are different variables. So okay, and then I think I will have to stop earlier. I will not discuss self-gravity, perhaps. It will be a good idea to do that. Then we looked at Grisha's new compressible Navier-Stokes flux relation, which is the exact relation using the same data, by the way. And so what I'm plotting here is average phi is a function of Ri over delta. Delta is the spacing of our numerical grid. And these are the black dots. And so 120 would be roughly 10 times smaller, or maybe 100 like here, than the driving scale. That's where we expect to have the beginning of the inertial range. And the line shows...
And where is driving scale here?
The driving scale, we inject energy at a scale of from 1024 to 512.
500.
In this unit, 512, yes. And then we need some, you know, space in K-space for relaxation, of course. Yeah. And it may be more than just a factor of five.
No hidden parameter. I mean, I'm proud.
So the line shows the right-hand side that was evaluated independently, basically. We know how we force. And so this right-hand side depends on the forcing and on the density field. And so it's not a fit here, it's just this dot should sit on that line, ideally. So that shows the quality. And so I included also the pressure term here, while it shouldn't be there because of the
isothermal
approximation. But actually, we were running adiabatic simulation with gamma equal 1.001 to mimic. So the pressure term contributes about 2%, and it's actually included into this point. So this is what we would expect. Now we also have the quality of this isothermal approximation. We can estimate how good is it using gamma 1.001 in this case. But we also compared with gamma exactly equal to 1 simulations done by other authors. So it's a good approach. And okay, so this is just to further illustrate. These are different average phi values as a function of R for different time moments.
What is phi?
Phi is
fifth order correlation.
The correlator.
That
thing.
Ah,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So there is a huge. That's time intermittency. What you can see here, and there is a huge spread. But it's funny that the average is right there.
Yeah, but that means that you have a good statistics.
And then
on a short time scale, you can measure whatever here.
Yeah, we have. Yeah. So, and then we were for these plots, we were using 64 snapshots, but we actually have three times more than that. So we haven't exhausted our data yet. But and this plot shows the PDF of phi. And I combine here the negative phi values and positive phi values in one plot. And so the upper curve shows phi for Ri equal to zero. And the lower one shows phi equal to 128 delta. And well, you can look at this carefully and explain why the positive, why do you get the positive correlation and why, and what the shape of the PDF is and such and such. So this is to conclude, and I think I will stop here. So what we find is that non-Kolmogorov velocity scaling is present at high Mach numbers. And supersonic turbulence is highly intermittent. And there is sort of energy cascade that you can recover by simply doing proper density weighting here. And finally, that the exact compressible Navier-Stokes flux relation is verified now at Mach 6. Thank you.
More questions, Cliff?
Concerning the interpretation of the images of the interstellar medium, if supernova explosions were the driving force, might you not expect to see little circular structures indicating a shockwave coming out from the points?
Yes, they are certainly present, but on larger scales. So the Storrs molecular cloud that you are probably referring to has a size of about 20 parsecs. So this structure doesn't have direct evidence of a big supernova shock propagating. But there are of course structures like this observed, and they are everywhere. But you have to look at larger scale images.
And I believe there were some very early investigations of shock waves by Jan Oort, perhaps from late 40s or early 50s. And he showed that the shock from a supernova gets weaker very rapidly, so that the radius increases very slowly as t to the 1/4. Is there any relationship between those ideas and the driving mechanisms that you're talking about?
Not direct. I don't think there is direct connection here. It's supernovae. So what you are talking about is supernovae remnants of different ages, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's sort of a different ISM. So in that case, the shock propagates through the multiphase gas. And here we have isothermal. It has different compressibility properties such and such. So it's hard to, maybe you can draw some analogy, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, there looks a little bit of confusion because in some places see the density weighting is the root of the power half, and some places you do the root of the power 1/3. So one would like to have a proper, you know what I mean?
It depends on what you want to get. If you want to get the energy distribution as a function of scale, you want to use 1/2. If you want to have a constant energy transfer rate, you want to use 1/3, right?
Let me put it this way. For short moment, you use 1/3. Yeah. For second moment, you use 1/3.
Yeah, okay.
Let me put it simple. So basically, it's moment dependent. You want a rho u squared, you use 1/2. You want a rho u cubed, you use 1/3. That's
okay.
Okay, thanks a lot. And again, this is here for 2 days, and we'll be back in May, but now if somebody wants to talk more, then we share the same office, so you're welcome to come to our office. And that's it.